welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri. In this series, I will be talking to academic staff about their research, their international networks, their aims and plans for the future. I shall also be hearing from staff and students about the many events that take place here at the University of Malta. This is the programme that keeps you informed about what's happening on campus. With me in the studio today on University Matters, I'm very pleased to have Professor Maria-Therese Camilleri-Podestà. Just a few words about my guest. She graduated in medicine and surgery from this university in 1969. She was appointed research assistant at University of Malta in 71, graduated MPhil from Malta in 75, and then completed her PhD at Guy's Hospital in London in 79. Professor Camilleri was the first female to be appointed full-time professor and head of department in 1981. And you remained practically on your own
for about 15 years.
For a long time. Fortunately,
things have changed.
We can talk a little bit about that later. She's headed the Department of Anatomy several times over the years and has also been acting head of the Department of Physiology and Biochemistry. She's responsible for the teaching of anatomy to medical and dental students, as well as to paramedical students. She's also an ex officio member of the faculty board of medicine and surgery, and also that of dental surgery, and is chairperson of the faculty admissions committee. She has collaborated with the Department of Clinical Pharmacology at the University of Malta and with the Department of Pathology to carry out in vitro testing on human cancer cell lines of various extracts from conifers and flowering plants. Members of the Lamiaceae and the Asteraceae, I'm sure you're going to correct me on that pronunciation, and the main work has concentrated on the induction of cytotoxicity on specific cancer cell lines and comparison of the activity on normal cells. Internationally, collaborations are ongoing with the Department of Bioorganic Pharmacy of Pisa and Nottingham University in the UK. And Professor Camilleri has also supervised a number of graduate students reading for both MPhil and PhD qualifications. She's also a member of the University Research Ethics Committee and of the Access Disability Support Committee. And she also chairs the Gender Issues Committee. Professor Camilleri is also appointed by the Maltese Law Courts to carry out medico-legal post-mortem examinations and in addition is a member of the Council of Health. She has several publications to her name. I won't even try and pronounce the titles, but take it from me, there are several there. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
You obviously have a very busy life.
Quite. Besides my family.
Of course. That's.
And three children. They're grown up.
Yes.
But and grandchildren. And another on the way.
So there's a lot going on. A lot to talk about in our 25 minutes slot. Perhaps we could start off by discussing what your university commitments are, really, starting with the lecturing, what yes. you actually lecture in.
Well, obviously I teach anatomy. Anatomy is the study of the structure of the human body, and it complements, the two complement each other. It complements physiology and biochemistry, because one is structure and the other is function. And obviously structure and function go together. So I've been at university since 1972. That means 40 years, which is a lifetime. I'm now teaching second generation students, which makes me very old. But I enjoy my contact with the students very much. Mm. I feel that, you know, it gives you energy and keeps you young at heart, if not physically.
And all the medical students actually go through your
yes.
hands, don't
yes,
they?
Yes.
Because they do a year here.
They do 2 years
on campus.
Here.
2 years here. I see.
Because we teach what are called the preclinical subjects. So first they do the normal, and then they move to hospital and study disease. Okay, so we're preclinical, and there it's clinical. Although we are trying to bridge the gap as much as possible to make it seamless as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. And anatomy is, I suppose, it's a basic, isn't it? I mean, one of those basics.
Yes, it's a basic. Many complain that there's a lot of memory. It's true, there's a lot of memory, but there is a logic. A lot of logic, and this is what I try to teach the students, you know, that you have to see why things are made that way, because then it makes sense. Otherwise, it's just studying facts, like parrots.
Mm, the number of bones in the body and all
And also to understand very often the words, the meaning of the words, because once you understand them, then you don't need to memorize them, you know. So I tell them, and another thing that I always say, students, is that you have you carry a textbook with you, which is your body. You carry it to exams, and you can always, well, to some extent, refer to certain superficial structures. But it's there, you know, and it helps.
And I can imagine that there's a beauty in the study of anatomy, yes, somehow.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Yesterday I was teaching on the inner ear, you know, the complications it entails. I mean, just to produce one sound. Imagine speech. I mean, the complexity of it is so intriguing.
Mm. And the number of students that you have, I mean, in the past there used to be a numerus clausus for medicine.
Now, of course, largest... When I graduated, we were a very big course, and we were 30. Huh? And there was by entry every 2 years. Now we admit every year, and we're having over 180 students. So that means that our resources are really stretched. It has its disadvantages, because before we knew the students personally, you created a certain rapport with them, which with very big numbers, it's much more difficult to create that feeling.
To match the large numbers, it would be nice if one had time for tutorials, but of course
we have what we call small group teaching, but the numbers, I mean, you cannot have the ideal number, which would be 6 to 8. It would involve too many contact hours. So we have, for example, the section sessions of 20 students. And that is a burden on the teacher and even on the students, because they have to see these very, especially my subject is head and neck. And they are very small structures. It's not like, you know, the thorax, you have the heart and the lungs, and they're much more easy to see. But when you're dealing with very tiny structures, it's not so easy.
What about technology? I'm thinking of when you have larger numbers, perhaps if you're showing things to students, are you able to benefit from technology?
We do video dissection sessions, so they get at least a general idea. It's better for some things than for others. But although today there are a lot of programs on the internet, on the sections and so on, it never replaces the real thing. You know, maybe I'm a bit old-fashioned, but even the students say that. When you actually see something, it's so different to seeing it as a picture.
Mm.
Having said that, obviously, our students are seeing corpses which have been fixed in formalin. Now we're going to try another process, which is called plastination, where the tissues remain much more lifelike. This has been tested abroad, and it's a very amazing technique. And there is actually a museum of these specimens, you know, so maybe...
So it's a method of keeping the specimens more fresh?
Yes, once you do it, it's for life. I mean, they remain in the same state, obviously, but handling by all the students does make the specimens deteriorate.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps I should say something about donations of bodies.
Yes, yes.
Many people tell you, do you have a problem with donations? Well, at the moment we don't, actually. We have a lot of donations from residents, permanent residents. We have very good relations with the British Residents Association. People are really encouraged, and I think they find that it solves certain problems, because once they pass away, we take over, and they don't have the problem of relatives having to come over and mm-hmm. so on. And then once a year we have a service in the chapel. We have a mass, but there is a service of Thanksgiving and in memory of these very generous people. Because
it is very generous,
and we invite the relatives, and they some of them come, obviously, if they can, and they appreciate it, you know, and we tell them how grateful we are, mm-hmm. because without their donations, we would have very serious problems. Mm.
Going on to research, which is obviously another pillar of your activity, of the activity of any academic here at the university. Do you find time for your research? This is always a big question.
Yes. You try to invest in having students, you know, rather than doing the actual physical research, which is obviously lab-based. I mean, it's not like in the arts, you can do it at any time and at any place today with the internet and so on. And we have to work in a lab. I have had over the years a steady stream of students, and we have produced some good work. Obviously, you always wish you had more time and more students. But considering the limitations of time and even funds, which are always very limited because the materials are very costly. So we are, restricted to a budget. And we have to work within that framework.
But doing research, as you've intimated, is a win-win situation, really, because it's a win situation for the students who have the opportunity to, under the guidance of somebody like yourself with experience, to begin their research activities as young students. And it's good for you because you have that resource to be able to do things.
Yes, in that way it's...
So it's a sort of symbiotic relationship.
Yes, it works well.
And this research, does it remain on the shelf? I mean, how do you use that research?
What we are doing is we are testing derivatives of plants, native plants, and nature is an enormous pharmacy, really. The number of chemicals it produces is unlimited, I would say. So we have this resource. If one finds, and we have found certain substances which are much more active than others, obviously, because it's not across the board, but if one found something which was very, very active, then it would just be the beginning of a long process, because then you have to do testing in animals, and eventually in man, and you have to pay. There's the question of patents, but so far, I mean, we haven't really struggled.
Well, it always requires a big effort to do that, and but still, it's no reason for not doing it.
You have to keep on. Enhances you, it enriches you, and it also helps others in the international field.
This is it.
To know what's happening.
What's happening? I mean, when you publish a paper in a journal that is international, then there are other people going to read it, and who might have been doing something similar, and then one thing leads to another.
It's a trigger.
Another pillar of the work of an academic here in the university is the activity on various boards. Sometimes this draws complaints from people, because it takes up a lot of one's time and this sort of thing. But it is an important part of the academic life, really, on campus. Why is that? How do you see that?
Obviously, somebody has to do the work. Sometimes it's very, very time-consuming. Certain boards are much more time-consuming than others. For example, I sit on the access committee, and over a period of 6 months, we meet every week practically for about 3 or 4 hours. And we look at applications for SEC and MedSEC from people who have some kind of disability, and we look at what can be provided to them to help overcome at least in part their disabilities. And it takes a lot of time because you have to make sure that the certification is correct, they have recent certificates from the professionals, and my remit is, because as a doctor, obviously I can contribute to assess to some extent people who have actual medical conditions. There are also other experts, like psychologists, who look at the other aspects.
But then you have it's an onerous task, really.
Yes, it is, but you learn. I think whatever you do, you learn from it. And yes, I never realized it was such a problem, such a vast problem.
And also, you're on the ethics committee.
Yes, the research ethics committee.
And explain a little bit what that does, in actual fact.
Basically, we look at applications for research. And the way it's done, there is a form online and people can download it, and then they put in the details. And first, there is a faculty research ethics committee, which vets the applications from the faculty. Okay, and once they are satisfied with that the applicant has fulfilled all the requirements, they send it over to us, and that is once a month. It's not so much, but before the meeting we get a pile of applications which we see at home or in the office, and then we go with our homework ready, sort of. And just
this is a sort of an example would be, say, an MPhil or a PhD student would be wanting to do some work, say, with minors.
Just minors, no. Anything involving human beings actually can have certain ethical aspects. We are only there to look at the ethics aspect. We are not there to judge the merit of the research, although sometimes we feel that, it's debatable, but we keep clear of that. It's just the ethics part. But yes, today most faculties, even for undergraduates purposes, carry out some kind of research. For example, the education department, psychology department, and they send us all these applications. So it's always growing.
The other committee which you're on is the Gender Issues Committee,
yes.
About which I know something myself, because I've been on the committee myself for many years. And I think that this is a committee that really has done a lot of work. Obviously, I can see it from my own point of view, because I know something about it, but it has done a lot of work over the years, and it's sort of there to raise awareness and to actually have a practical side to it as well.
And we try to, I must say that all the members have their own job to do. So this is very much an extra. And we don't have a department on gender issues, as many universities have. And the other thing worth mentioning is that in many universities abroad, there are incentives to the university to sort of align themselves with certain demands by the European Union. And they get financial help. And if they don't, you know, meet certain requirements, then they will lose the money. So there are very, very strong incentives. Unfortunately, we are not in that happy situation. So we have to push. But I feel that we have made some progress. As, for example, you mentioned that I was the first professor and remained so. And today, thank God, we have several academics, female academics, who are full professors or associate professors. But still, there is a pyramid. There are a lot of women at the bottom, at assistant lecturer and lecturer status. And the more you rise up the ladder, the fewer the number. And the disparity between men and women becomes more obvious.
Well, I'd love to go on talking about that for some time, but unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time. Let's move on a little bit to your forensic work.
Yes.
Forensics has become a bit of a buzzword these last years. You describe it as a service to the community. Also, it can be a basis for some research as well. How do you really see this part of your work?
Yes, I got into it because actually when I was a very young person, I was doing research on a disease which was called diverticular disease. It's a very common condition, and I was looking at the incidence of diverticular disease. And I decided to look at it in postmortems, because that is when you can really see the diverticular. There are also radiology, but you can miss some of them. And I did both radiological and postmortem incidents. That's how I started. And then I was encouraged by the persons doing the postmortems at the time. You know, why don't you, once you're here, you might as well learn how to do it yourself. And though in particular, I wish to mention Dr. Alfred Azzopardi, who is retired. He was the one who really sort of encouraged me a lot. And since then, I haven't looked back, I mean. Now there are three of us basically who do postmortems. I'm one of the three, so, and the workload has increased a lot. This year we have a record. We have today we had the 222nd case. usually up to a couple of years ago, literally a couple of years ago, we used to have 115 a year. So the numbers have increased. First of all, why do we do postmortems?
I was going to what are the occasions on which you would have to do it?
Postmortems are required by law in certain circumstances. When I specify forensic postmortems, because there are also hospital postmortems, which are done as part of an internal investigation. If somebody dies in hospital and they're not quite sure about the cause of death, then that is done as an internal thing. And this, I do the ones where a magistrate is involved, and I'm appointed by the inquiring magistrate. First of all, you have cases of sudden deaths. So anybody who dies suddenly, even if he goes to hospital and does not and dies before an interval of 48 hours, then unless he has a doctor who knows his clinical history, then he has to have a postmortem. And today, because the culture of general practice has dwindled somewhat. Before, everybody had his GP who knew him well. And today, many people just go to the polyclinic, and so they don't have a doctor who knows the person. So we have quite a few of these cases. But we also obviously get a lot of foreigners who come to Malta, elderly people usually who come to Malta and just pass away while they're on holiday here. So that is a sizable part of our work. But then also we have any violent death. And that includes not just the very obvious violent deaths like murders and suicides, okay, including, for example, hanging and so on, even drug-related cases, because you have to prove that there is an overdose of drugs, so we take samples for toxicology, but also things which may seem very obvious to people, like motor traffic accidents or drowning. Those also require postmortems. And then also people who are in Mount Carmel Hospital with a sentence from court. Those also have to have a postmortem examination. So it's quite a wide case.
It's fascinating talking to you. It's a really interesting subject. Unfortunately, our time is over. I would like to thank Professor Maria-Therese Camilleri-Podestá for coming to talk to us today on University Matters. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us on University Matters. You can listen to any of the previous interviews in this series on the Campus FM website. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.